From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Language is widely considered to be as much a function of gender as any other gender expression, whether clothing, gender normative interests, such as interior decorating, or personality traits. But is language so different between the sexes? Caroline Myrick teaches undergraduate courses in English linguistics, sociology, and women and gender studies at North Carolina State University. She also works for the Language and Life Project and Linguistics Lab and is a member of the Language Diversity Ambassadors. Caroline Myrick, welcome to Coastline.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And we are inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question about language and gender, send it to coastline@whqr.org. A bit later in the program, we'll open the phone lines. So, Caroline Myrick, let's talk first about why we're even talking about this topic today. What is the Language and Life Project, and what do you do as a language diversity ambassador?
Sure. So the Language and Life Project at NC State University is a nonprofit where our central goal is to celebrate language diversity, document language diversity, and then educate the community at large, not just the university, but the North Carolina community, for instance, about what's great about language diversity.
And what is language diversity? What are we talking about? Is it accents, regionalisms? Is it word usage?
All of that, absolutely. So we talk about North Carolina, for instance. So much variation in North Carolina when it comes to language. We've got a lot of regional dialects within North Carolina. We have a lot of ethnic dialects. And, of course, what we're going to talk about today is gender diversity when it comes to language. So what we really focus on is, you know, the celebration of it, the documentation of it, and then just educating people on the fact that these varieties of English and other languages are just as equal, just as rule governed, just as special, just as history bound as each other.
And we've actually done a previous episode of Coastline on African American vernacular English, and Walt Wolfram, who I think
is my advisor.
Yes, yep. and a guru in this field, a legend, talked about how that is as complex and has just as many rules as any other language.
Absolutely.
But when we look at the differences, or what we think of as the differences between the way men and women speak, are we also there talking about tonal differences or word usage differences, phrases that, for instance, someone today said to me, "Oh, sorry, I just wanted to ask you." And would that have been a man or a woman who said that to me?
Right. So I think we run into a lot of the same issues comparing African American English to quote, quote, standard English as we do with men's versus women's language, because men traditionally have occupied positions of power in the U.S., we tend to associate the speech that we associate with those males as the standard. And so when we encounter features that are associated with females, unsurprisingly, those tend to get labeled as either weak or hesitant or sometimes even just plain stupid.
And what are some examples of that? I mean, there's the sorry thing.
Right.
And is that something that women should try to move away from? Do women, in fact, say that more than men do?
So there's been a lot of research about the sorts of things that women do more than men. Robin Lakoff was one of the first people to write about this in the 70s and had a list of things that women did more of. And this included tag questions such as, you know, right? Things like adjectives. Things like
men don't use adjectives. Well, they're missing a whole part of speech.
I know. Well, when women use them, they become labeled empty adjectives, or even empty adverbs such as very and quite. These have traditionally been associated with women, and it sounds silly, right? Because we know that men use these things, and almost all of Lakoff's research was based on anecdotal evidence, which is, as we think in the science community now, a little problematic. And we're finding that a lot of these sort of myths and stereotypes about women's language comes from a lot of anecdotal evidence and not so much scientific evidence.
You recently published a dictionary of Caribbean English. And can you just talk about the role that a dictionary plays in our culture today versus how the idea of a dictionary originated?
Yeah. So I just helped with a dictionary called a LEACHIP, the Dictionary of Sabin English. It's documenting words, phrases, grammar, and pronunciation of the tiny island of Saba in the Dutch Caribbean. And I find dictionaries such an interesting thing. When I talk to my students about it, it tends to kind of blow their minds when they think about the fact that dictionaries were written by people, just like you and me. And the point of a dictionary, especially in our case, was to document and preserve and show how language was used on Saba. But so many people tend to think of dictionaries as telling you how to talk. You know, I'm sure you've had experiences in school where, you know, how do you pronounce this? How do you spell this? And the teacher says, go look it up. And the dictionary tells you how to do it. But if you really think about what a dictionary is doing, it's preserving language and showing how people use language. That's why there's constantly new editions, right? Because it's documenting what's really going on in real life.
And you tell a story about an essay written by the Grimm brothers in the 15th century that kind of addresses the idea of prescriptivism.
I love explaining to my students, because many of them have parents that have said, oh man, the English language is just going downhill. We probably all know people that have said that. But people have been saying that for centuries and centuries and centuries. We have the brothers Grimm talking about it. We have Benjamin Franklin talking about it. And they're complaining about either grammatical structures or pronunciations that they think are just awful and that today you and I would use without even thinking about it.
So you've actually made a pretty strong statement about rules, gender rules for language around, especially where women are concerned. You've said that policing women's language is the same thing as policing women. Is that a leap, or why do you say that? How are women policed?
Sure. I mean, I think that to some may sound like an extreme statement, but I'm merely looking at data. And so lots of data shows that the different things that women are doing with their speech are features that are used by their male counterparts. And yet we see more negative reactions to it when women use those features. So there have been countless perception studies, so studies where speech samples are played for listeners, and they'll have men and women using the same feature. Of course, it's more complicated than this, but essentially what they're looking at is people's reactions to it. And overwhelmingly, you see that women receive the more negative critiques or reactions. They're labeled as more unintelligent, or they don't sound as confident, or they don't sound as authoritative. Even when they're played a sound clip with a male using the same feature, they don't get those same ratings. So just based on those sorts of experiments, we can see that there's something going on besides just the policing of language.
Going back to this idea of women apologizing, you know, I asked you in the very beginning about sorry, and do women say that as much as men do, or do they say it more?
Mm-hmm.
And Melissa writes, it seems like women are often trained to apologize for everything, regardless of who does the wrongdoing. Sometimes it seems like women must apologize for their very existence. Warranted apologies should be genderless, but they're not. How can women work on removing excessive use of the word sorry from their vocabulary while still maintaining awareness about when an apology is actually warranted? And further, how can men be made aware of this issue, and how can men be encouraged to be more apologetic? Hashtag sorry, not sorry.
I love it. I think what's really important in that question is the fact that this emailer used the word trained. Women are trained. And I think that socialization explains so much of the differences that we do see between men and women. So when it comes to women's use of apologies or other politeness forms, a lot of this has to do with socialization. You can just go into any store that sells toys and you can see that boys and girls are socialized differently, right? We have, for kind of inexplicable reasons, boys' toys and girls' toys, right? So we know that we treat boys and girls differently as they grow up. We talk to them differently. We teach them different politeness norms. And that's really what has to do, and that's what explains the fact that we do see women apologizing a lot more. And I like that the emailer mentioned, you know, unwarranted versus warranted apologies. I run into a lot of people that think that women should just never apologize. And I think what's bigger, what the bigger issue is looking at why we're using the language in the first place, right? Rather than just saying, don't do this or do this.
You say that men and women are treated differently from the time they're very small.
Oh, yeah.
Are there any studies that explore how, say, babies are treated when we know their genders?
Yeah. One of my favorites is where in an experiment, people are presented with babies, and they're told that the baby is a girl, or they're told that it's a boy. And in a lot of these experiments, it's really the same baby the whole time. They're just told that it's a different sex. And the way that people describe the baby, they describe the boy baby as being bigger, stronger, more troublesome, more rambunctious. But not just in the ways that they describe it, but people tend to interact and talk to baby girls differently than baby boys. So they will use higher pitch when they're talking to a baby girl. They'll use more diminutives, like adding E, like oopsie, and like whoopsie, like E to the end. They'll do lots of repetition, like boo-boos, things like that with girls. So we see a lot of different speech patternings happen just when we're told, hey, you're talking to a baby girl right now.
And so what message does that send to the child then?
Yeah, well, I mean, from the beginning, if girls are being treated differently, if they, you know, are surrounded by higher pitch, if they're surrounded by diminutives, which are essentially a lot of times euphemisms, which relate to politeness norms, women, I think, are told from the beginning to be either less direct or perhaps more polite. I could go on and on.
And I'm going to ask you more about that when we come back. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about language and gender with Caroline Myrick, who teaches English linguistics, sociology, and women and gender studies at NC State. After this short break, we'll open the phone lines. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking about language, how rapidly it changes, how we use it to judge other people. Do you think you know the rules of grammar? Are certain vocal mannerisms the exclusive domain of women or men? We're challenging those ideas today with Caroline Myrick, who teaches language and gender studies courses at NC State. The phone lines are now open. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And I think we have a clip from a film called In a World, starring Lake Bell. She also directed this film. And this is just a useful part of the film, I think, because what we hear is there are a couple of components of this that we can kind of pick apart and use to analyze the way we judge women's voices. This is In a World is a film about voiceover artists, and part of the plot involves a competition between a father and daughter. They're both voiceover artists. The father is an older white man who has that traditional sort of godlike, authoritative, and he does voiceovers for film trailers in a world. So, and Lake Bell is sort of coming up as the new female voice, and the question is, will this female voice be accepted as authoritative, as something that can market films? But there's a subplot going on related to how we perceive female voices. So let's just take a listen.
This Wednesday, one woman will teach another woman to sound a little less...
Can I get a smoothie around here?
I don't know where you'd get a smoothie around here at all. I'm so sorry.
Oh, okay. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no worries.
In a world.
In a world.
In a world.
Well...
Yeah, okay, thanks so much. So, you know, we hear that, and immediately most of us are very critical of how those female voices sounded. We're making fun of them in that film.
Yep.
So can you tell us about the components that we're making? What are we making fun of here and why?
Yeah, so there's multiple interesting things going on in that little imitation. Of course, we have, you know, what they're actually talking about, smoothies. It seems like a very sort of superfluous conversation off the bat. But then we have some very high pitch. the pitch is quite high, especially compared to, like you said, that in a world voice. So mm-hmm. we do see a huge difference in that average pitch there. We also hear some uptalk, so sentences that are ending kind of like a question. And then we also hear that creaky voice, so it gets a little bit deeper and rumbly like that. So there's all those things going on in just that short little clip.
And in the beginning, you hear Lake Bell's voice, and it's that female voice, sort of sultry, and she says, in a world. And it's too low for her. She's trying to hit a pitch that's mm-hmm. just too low for her physically, and so she creaks.
Yes.
And that's part of the exploration in this film is just accept your own voice.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, so those were some interesting features to focus in on in that clip, because uptalk is one of the most sort of policed features of, we'll say, women's speech.
Is it only women who do that?
It is not. We know that everyone uses uptalk, because if you have ever asked a question before, you've likely used uptalk to show that it's a question. You might say, do you want fries with that? Are you going to the movies later? And that's how you're showing that it's a question. But of course, we know that we can ask questions without uptalk too. We can say, you're really wearing that. So they're not necessarily tied to questions, but because a lot of people associate uptalk with asking questions, it's been now associated with uncertainty, because a lot of times when you ask questions, it's because you're uncertain. But now people are saying that if you declare some sort of statement with uptalk, that you must be uncertain, and that's why you have this associated question intonation. So if I said, I think I'm going to go get some coffee, you might have some people that would say, oh, are you sure? Because it has this rap of being uncertain now.
But, and why would you say it that way?
Well, there are a lot of reasons that people use uptalk to do things besides ask a question or show uncertainty. One of them is to create solidarity or to invite other people into the conversation. So if I said, I'm going to go get some coffee, I guarantee it that at least one other person might say, oh, can you grab me some, or oh, I'll go with you. It is very much implied with my intonation that I want to know people's reactions to me getting coffee, whether it be picking them up some, seeing if anyone wants me to get anything while I'm up. So it's that invitation to get in on this thing that I'm talking about. And so in that case, that's not uncertain at all. I know what I'm doing. I know I'm getting coffee. I know I want others to react. And in that way, it's very authoritative speech, in my opinion.
I could also hear someone saying, you're asking permission.
Right, yeah. And so once again, that's tied into this idea that uptalk is just used for questions. And again, I find it silly because it's not even really tied to questions. You can ask so many questions with falling intonation. Oh, did you see her new shoes? Or, are you going out later? These are questions that you can ask without the intonation. So this idea that rising intonation is tied to, like, you not knowing something is just not really scientifically accurate.
Is that part of it, too, though? You're listening to Coastline? I mean, when I say that on the air, it has less meaning because I can't hear back from
exactly.
the audience. But if I'm talking to you and I say, we're talking about language, mm-hmm. it's dynamism and how it relates to our understanding of gender. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that I'm seeking your approval and I want you to nod and say, yes, that's what this is about?
It could be. But what's interesting is when I hear that, to me, it sounds like you're signaling to me, wait a minute, don't interrupt, I'm not done talking. And that's a big, big thing that uptalk does, is really solidifies your floor time. You're saying, look, I'm still talking. So if I'm telling you a story and I'm saying, so I was down in Wilmington and I went to the beach, it doesn't sound like I want you to jump in quite yet. You can just feel that I'm leading up to something, like the big point of this story. And so another way that uptalk is really powerful is you're showing, wait a minute, not done, leading up to something. So that's how I would interpret it. But of course, a lot of people might interpret it as seeking approval or other sorts of stereotypes we have, like about women these days.
You're listening to Coastline. We are talking about language and how it changes and the differences, the gender differences, and the perceptions of those gender differences. Caroline Myrick is here to answer your questions. She teaches courses in English linguistics, sociology, and women and gender studies at North Carolina State University. If you have a question or a comment, you can call us today at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. What are some of the biological factors that come into play with gender differences? Just basic anatomy. How does that play into the way men and women speak?
Yeah, so a lot of people say, oh, well, you can't just tell me that everything is socially constructed and that it's all identity-based. And sure, there are lots of anatomical factors that go into why you sound like you sound. And the fact that someone can call you on the phone and you'll have a pretty good chance at guessing if it's a man or a woman, maybe, based on their voice, shows that there's something going on anatomically. And that really centers around the vocal tract or the stuff that's going on in your throat and in your mouth and in your nose, but chiefly the vocal tract area and around where the vocal cords are. That area, the neck area, your vocal tract tends to be larger if you're a man, and that's what causes an average of lower pitch. So on average, men will sound deeper and women will sound higher pitch.
So is that why people sound higher pitched when they get scared? Because things contract?
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of anatomical stuff that coincides with emotions, absolutely. When people are, you know, scared, they also might sound really breathy because they're gasping for air. And so breathy, you can use breathy voice to mean all sorts of things. But yeah, it totally coincides with just average emotions and physical reactions. Yeah.
Well, so going back to that clip, In a World with Lake Bell, you know, there's this, the main plot, once again, is the older male, white male, upper middle class voice versus this younger female voice, and whether the young female voice can be accepted as authoritative, as legitimate. And then we're poking a lot of fun at some of these other female voices. And you just talked about some of the anatomical differences and why we sound different. But there are some vocal coaches, for instance, who would say, oh my gosh, when a woman talks up here and she starts to sound like this, it's like it's kind of a subconscious, submissive thing that's happening that she's doing. Like she may not be consciously doing it, and it may not even be where her real physical voice is placed. And so a vocal coach could help her drop into her voice and inhabit herself, be fully present. I mean, is there something to that? Is some of the criticism about the fact that maybe women aren't fully inhabiting themselves and that's being expressed vocally?
That's totally possible. I mean, I think what's interesting about pitch and how it's more than just something biological is that we know that it's cultural. So if it were purely biology affecting our pitch, then men and women around the world would have the same average pitch. But if we look at the average pitch of a man and woman in the U.S. versus, for instance, in Japan, we see that on average, men in Japan speak a lot lower and women in Japan speak a lot higher than we do here in the U.S. And there's no biological explanation for that, so we know that it must be something societal, something cultural. And it is. With language in Japan, femininity and masculinity are extremely tied to language. And so higher pitch is very, very feminine and is expected if you're a woman that you're going to have high pitch. We don't have as strong of a tie, perhaps, which could explain why our men's and women's voices in the U.S. are a little bit closer to each other than they are in Japan. So we can see, yeah, there's something biological going on, but it's also very cultural. So with the girls that are talking really high that you're talking about, it's totally possible that they're manipulating this because of what society is telling them being feminine is.
And is that, are we equating feminine to submissive?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at any of the features that become associated with women, whether or not we use them more, things like the empty adjectives, the tag questions, asking questions in general, they all tend to go with what are considered weak language features. So it's not surprising that these get tacked on to women's characteristics.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about language and how it relates to our perceptions of gender and gender differences. Caroline Myrick is here to answer your questions. She teaches at NC State. You can ask your question by calling 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. And from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, Rachel. You have the best example of a excuse me, I do have a cold. I'm not speaking, you know, as a girly voice.
That's okay. We're not judging your voice, Anne.
No, good. You have the ideal female voice for broadcast, as I've told you in person. It's the best I've ever heard. It's wonderful. And anybody who can come close is lucky. I want to say one thing.
Thank you.
Caroline.
Yes.
I'm awfully glad you're taking up this subject because my husband and I constantly, on a daily basis, are commenting, oh, a little girly voice, you got a little girly voice. You know, how are we expected to take them seriously when they talk that way? And I used to teach public speaking, and I've done some consulting with some TV, female TV reporters locally to try to, and it's a simple matter, you know, to get your voice down lower. And it's made a world of difference. But I want to observe something about your own speaking voice. Please drop the like. That's characteristic, you know, currently. And it's got to go out because it just isn't really a good idea. The other thing, you speak quickly. And this is something I've noticed in my granddaughters and daughters' generation. The women speak like this, you know. And I get the impression it's sort of, gosh, I'm afraid somebody's going to shut me up, so I better talk real quick.
Okay, those are some interesting perceptions,
and
we're
going to
we are going to comment on it.
Good.
Thank you so much for your call. Sorry about that, Anne. So many things are raised here.
Yes.
First of all, there's the idea of how a broadcaster's voice should sound, and this is something that came up at NPR nationally when we switched the underwriting announcer. I say we, I'm not part of this at all. We are just a member station. But in Washington, D.C., when NPR was having their underwriting announcer, you know, that's support for NPR comes from. This was a guy named Frank, and he'd done it forever. They hired a younger woman, and she had a higher-pitched voice, of course. She sounded probably like she was in her early 20s, and there was a huge backlash against this voice, and so they brought in some other voices then, and now she's part of a mix of female voices. And there was just so much judgment around that, around the tone and and I don't know if it was a pitch issue or a breathy issue, but can you speak to that, Caroline, why we judge that so harshly?
Yeah, I do remember when NPR had this new voice and a lot of the commentary centered around her being creaky or using vocal fry, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. And what is vocal fry? What are we talking about?
Yes. So vocal fry, or as linguists call it, a funnier name, creaky voice, is when you're vocal folds in your throat vibrate a little bit more slowly than usual. So if I start talking like this, you can actually put your hand on my throat and feel the vocal folds vibrating. And that's creaky voice. And it sounds silly when I do it there, but we all use creaky voice all the time to accomplish lots of different things. But one of the main things that it does is it tells your conversation partner that you're done talking. So a lot of times I'll use that rising intonation to show that I'm not done talking, but then when I am done talking, I'll get creaky.
And I'm going to draw out the end of my sentence.
Exactly.
Did I just creak?
Yeah.
So I fried.
Absolutely. Yeah, most people on the radio use creak very subtly, but usually to show that they're at the very end of a topic or, you know, a large utterance. So it's very helpful for listeners. And so you use it in a very helpful way.
And men do it, too.
Oh, yeah. Everyone does it.
But we pick on women for it.
We sure do. And I imagine that a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, creak is a very low, low tone. So because women on average do have a higher pitch, it's going to be potentially more noticeable if a woman does it because it's a more different pitch change than for like a low speaking man who's low anyway. But everyone does it. And it's another one of those things where we just have to look across cultures to see that it's not necessarily tied to women. In the UK, for instance, a lot of working class guys will use creak to show that they're really tough. We've seen this in California, too. A lot of gang members will use it, male specifically, to show that they're really tough and they've seen stuff. And this is very different than our sort of Kim Kardashian associations with creaky voice, right? It's not showing uncertainty. It's not showing airheadedness. For them, it's showing hardcoreness and toughness. So it's very interesting to see how the gender of the speaker changes how we perceive it.
It is interesting. I mean, for a very traditionally masculine, I should say, heterosexual male, when he fries vocally, it's sexy.
Sure.
It's simian.
Absolutely.
It's primal.
I have my students, a lot of them say, oh, I never use creaky voice. And so I'll ask some of the guys in the class, you know, how do you talk when you pick up the phone when a girl that you like calls you? And I have them imitate themselves. How would you talk to a girl that you really like? And all of a sudden, they get really creaky. They're like, hey, baby, what's up? I'm like, there you go. There's your creaky voice. And so when they do it, we don't think, oh, what an airhead. Like you said, it sounds sexy, it sounds cool, it sounds relaxed. And these are all things that creaky voice does.
So let's talk about the word like.
Yes.
A lot of us use this in conversation. And how do we use it? When we say like, it's not I like you, but like he said this and then he was like, and like, this is what I think.
Yes.
How am I using? Oh, there's the music.
Well, I'm excited to tell you about all the functions of like when we come back, because there are a lot, and it's definitely a generational shift that's happening. Young people love to use it, older folks not so much, but we can list them all out.
Okay, good. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, talking about language and gender. When we come back, we're going to hear about like, and we'll also talk to Eric. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. This is Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're exploring the intersection of power, language, and gender with Caroline Myrick, who teaches language and gender studies at NC State. You have a few minutes left to ask your question today, and in just a moment, we're going to talk to Eric. But the number for you to call is 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Caroline, just before we went to break, we started to address the word like and how we use it today and what the implications of that are.
Yeah, so like is such a great example of perceptions of women's speech. I have so many people tell me that young girls these days, they use like so much. And it's absolutely 100% true that young people are using like more and in new ways compared to their parents and grandparents. However, the data actually shows that young women are not using like any more than men. In fact, a lot of studies show us that young men are using like a little bit more than women.
Young men use like a little bit more than women, but we attribute that, we consider that a female speech mannerism.
Sure, absolutely. And once again, I think it goes to the perception of like being, we'll call it a form of hesitation, which we have hesitation and uncertainty associated with femininity. So I think you can make the link there. But like has a lot of new functions for young people. So whereas my parents and grandparents probably just use like to compare something, this pen is like this pencil because they both write things. Okay. But people in my generation are using it for a lot more. So one of those things is to introduce speech, which is the example that you gave before the break. So I might be telling a story of, I met with my advisor and he was like, how's your dissertation coming? And I was like, whoa, I'm working on it. So those are instances where like is replacing the word said or replied or exclaimed. And that's a very stylistic choice by young people. I think if I were to say, and then I replied and then he exclaimed, people would think I'm a square. It sounds very, very formal. It just does not sound normal. So that's definitely a new one. And another new one is the idea that you can show estimation. I was in line for like 10 minutes and blah, blah, blah. So that's an example where, you know, don't hold me to it. It might have been 8 minutes. It might have been 15 minutes. But like is really showing that you're estimating. And this is one where this tends to be catching on with older folks, too. They're catching a lot of these things, perhaps, from their kids. But we, of course, the additional function of like is as a filler. So like is the new And I definitely use that as a filler more often than which is probably why you've heard me say it today when I'm thinking about things or I want to gather my thoughts. And
right.
So,
like.
Exactly.
Like that.
Yeah. Yep. And so probably in the past 30 minutes, I've used like as a filler, but I've also probably used it to introduce speech and to estimate. However, to the older generation, they'll hear all those and bunch them together and say, wow, she's using a lot of fillers, when actually I'm using it for a lot of functions, and so are my peers my age.
And we need to talk more about the dynamism of language and how rapidly it actually changes. But let's get to Eric, who's been patiently holding. Eric, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks.
Hi.
I have a major question, Professor Meyer. Does any of the data show correlations between African-American male pitch and what would be ascribed to female pitch standards? I'm curious because as a rule, and I'm African-American male myself,
mm-hmm.
but as a rule when interacting with authority like the police,
mm-hmm.
to let them know immediately, well, don't make presumptions on education or even access to money, that sort of thing. I'll speak more rapidly in a high-pitched voice to them, and I know that those things seem less aggressive or are seen as more educated, more middle class. Does your data tease any of those correlations out?
Yeah, all of your insights there are spot on. Even though we do tend to associate femininity with weakness, we also tend to associate it with standardness, professionalism, educatedness, or at least middle classness. So
mm-hmm.
So those associations you're making are exactly right. And I'm glad that you brought in that intersection of ethnicity into gender, because unfortunately so much of the research on language and gender over the past couple decades has really focused on middle class white speakers, typically from from a few areas. But what I do know with relation to pitch, or at least with intonation with the African American English speaking community, is that intonation is really used in different ways by African American speakers. And so I think you're definitely picking up on something with all these things that you've noticed. Black males especially will use intonations in a lot different ways than white males will, especially with going up higher pitch more often, going lower more often too. So there's a little bit more dynamism going on there. So yeah.
Eric, I'm curious. Are you saying that if you were to encounter a white police officer, for instance, would you consciously change the way you speak? Is that a conscious thing that happens or is it unconscious?
Change the way you speak. I see it more as accessing a certain range of speech.
Sure.
For the occasion.
Sure.
But yeah, I do. I do deliberately. I've been accused of either being a caricature of a white person
mm-hmm.
because I use standard English. And I laugh. It's like, well, English is the noun, and aren't we all taught English in public school?
Mm-hmm.
It's a standard. How do you ascribe race to that? That's racist.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't
mm-hmm.
see what I was saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I laid it out pretty well. But no, I do make that conscious choice often. If I want to demonstrate whiteness or access to money or middle classness, and those things seem to be synonymous, then I'll make certain that my voice is modulated a certain way immediately. And then the cue is caught, and then we move on. It works. So mm-hmm. I've done it. But I didn't know if there were studies that teased that out, because I don't want to go just on my own experience.
Sure. I mean, I definitely think that you're noticing something that is absolutely scientifically backed. The fact that we do associate, you know, toughness and masculinity and aggressiveness with males, that switching over to those stereotypically female things like higher pitch, rapid speech, that mm-hmm. makes perfect sense. So I think you're spot on with what you're doing there.
Eric, thank you. Thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it. We also have Rebecca from Wilmington. Rebecca, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for taking my call. My question was this. Where does regional accent fit into this picture? I think we all know in broadcast journalism, for instance, the accent is, as someone who screened me said, neutral. I call it a Midwest accent or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm a Southern woman. So I was raised in the South and did some broadcast journalism in the distant past, and I changed my accent for that reason.
And that's something that you had to do to get a job, Rebecca?
Yeah, I think so. Or at least that was my perception. Okay. Because that's what was done. I mean, that's what was happening. That's what I heard in broadcast journalism. So I also was, you know, in theater a bit. It started there, I think. But now I find myself, I have this not-so-Southern accent. Some words are. But I find myself sort of going back sometimes. It depends on who I'm around, to a Southern accent. As I get older, it's kind of like, well, I like it.
So is that something, first of all, there's the question about regionalisms, Caroline.
Yeah.
And is that something that we should be preserving instead of trying to get rid of?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of our biggest sort of mission statements of the Language and Life Project is really getting people to be proud of the way that they speak. There's so much history tied to the many North Carolina dialects, so much culture, so much tradition that, yeah, that's definitely one of our big messages. But of course, we all style shift, right? So it makes sense that we might talk a certain way in different situations or at work.
Rebecca, thank you so much for your call. She brings up a number of issues around that. Could someone with a very identifiable Southern accent be a credible, say, newscaster, do you think? Are we at the point in our acceptance of regionalisms that we would just sort of listen through that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wish we were at the point where I could say yes, but there's still a lot of research that shows that we have these age-old stereotypes of the dumb Southerner or the fast-talking, manipulative Northerner, right? It goes both ways. And then when that intersects with gender, you know, we get things like the sweet, innocent Southern belle versus the dumb-sounding Southern male. So you can see there's, like, the stereotypes in regions tend to be split by gender as well. So, yeah, it's complicated, and I don't think we're there yet, but I think addressing all of those stereotypes within stereotypes will hopefully get us there.
Let's talk about how rapidly language changes, because this is something I think we started to address when we talked about prescriptivism and how there are people out there that say, well, this is how you should speak, and this is a good voice and this is not, or this is a proper grammatical use of this word and this is not. But you say that there really isn't any scientific basis for that. Is that right?
Yeah, so a lot of people interpret that as me saying that, oh, any way you talk is fine. There's no rules for anything. It's just have a heyday with language. But what's more accurate is that we do have these regional dialects, and we have these ethnic dialects. We have gender-based and sexuality-based dialects that are governed by rules in the same way that standard English is governed by rules. And those rules aren't any better or any worse. They're just rules.
So when we talk about the differences between men's and women's speech, we're largely talking about the differences between people who identify as heterosexual.
Sure.
Are there differences in people who are gay in terms of their speech patterns? Are those identifiable? Are there different patterns there?
So we've only very recently, at least in the history of linguistics, had folks studying the speech of non-heterosexual individuals. And the majority of this research has looked at homosexual males and seeing if there is a gay speech or a gay dialect. And there have been a lot of perception tests. You know, a lot of people will say that they have, and I put this in quotes, gaydar. And when you ask people, well, how do you know if someone's gay? They'll usually say, the first thing they say will either be the way that they dress, the way that they move, or the way that they talk. And so a lot of researchers have been trying to zero in on this talk thing. What is the talk thing? And what they've found is that when people are deciding someone's sexual orientation based on their speech, they tend to listen to the pronunciation or duration of the S sound. So there used to be kind of a stereotype of a gay male lisp. It's not actually a lisp. It has to do more with how you say the S and how long you hold it for. There's also a T sound. So I might say the word what, and a gay male might say what, and have a little more of a release there. But there's also some vowels that are involved too. So if people hear someone using vowels, which we associate with California, so talking more like this, then they also will associate that with homosexuality, at least with males. And while some of these are stereotypes, there's also plenty of studies that show that gay males use these things to really index or emphasize their sexuality. So, for instance, Rob Podesva did a study in California where he looked at a gay male in three different situations. One of them was at work, one of them was at dinner with friends, and one was boys' night out, so out clubbing. And during the boys' night out, when he was being more flirty, more fun, maybe more romantic, he was really emphasizing all of these sort of stereotypical elements of gay male speech. So whether or not it actually is we'll say a dialect, we can see that gay men are using it if they want to really emphasize part of their sexuality, which I think is cool, because that's what's so cool about language, is that we can use it to portray a message, to tell something about ourselves. And if it's successful, then that's great.
So it's like putting on a piece of clothing, or it's expressing. It's a way we express ourselves.
Absolutely. I use the comparison between language and clothing so much, because none of us talk the same way all day long, just like none of us most likely would wear the same thing to work as we would to the pool, as we would to a club, etc. It's part of our style.
Are there studies on lesbian speech? You're talking about gay males, but what about lesbians or bisexual people?
Yeah, this definitely is the area where the biggest gap exists. There have been some studies of lesbian speech looking at pitch, for example, with the expectation, oh, well, if gay men are perhaps using a higher pitch, maybe gay women are using a lower pitch. There haven't been any significant findings that that's true with pitch. But a lot of people think that perhaps being a gay male, the rejection against masculinity is stronger than a lesbian rejection of femininity. But as you can see, there just needs to be a lot more research in that area.
So if you were to think about some of your mission as part of the Language and Life Project and being a language diversity ambassador, if there was a misconception that you could dispel about language, what would that be? What would you really like people to understand?
I think my one thing that I hope every student in my class takes away is that standard English is just one of a plethora of Englishes. Standard English is so great for a lot of different reasons, but there are other Englishes that are great for other reasons and for all sorts of different stylistic reasons or ways that you talk to your family, things like that. So showing, just getting the message across that standard English was created, right? We decided which things would be considered standard. Understanding that it's pretty arbitrary what's considered standard and what's not, and that everything is just as cool, just as special, just as communicative, I think is really great.
Very well said. That's this edition of Coastline. Caroline Myrick, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
You can now hear Coastline twice a week on Wednesdays and Thursdays at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Today's show was produced by Claudia Thompson and Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Aurora Shimshak engineered today's show. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes Store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.